Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Lee Harvey Oswald is a name forever linked to one of the darkest days in American history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. As the alleged lone gunman in Dealey Plaza on November 22, 1963, Oswald became the central figure in a story that continues to inspire intense debates, endless speculation, and a host of conspiracy theories. Today, we'll explore eight compelling reasons why many believe Lee Harvey Oswald was innocent in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Number one, the rifle didn't fit the crime.
So you take this Carcano, one of the worst shoulder weapons, and you try to hit a moving target at 88 yards through heavy foliage, no way. FBI tried two sets of tests. Not one of their sharpshooters could match Oswald's performance. Not one. And Oswald was at best a medium shot. The scope was defective on it too. I mean, this is the whole essence of the case to me. The guy couldn't do the shoot. Nobody could. And they sold this lemon to the American public.
One of the initial concerns raised by skeptics regarding Oswald's guilt pertains to the rifle purportedly used to assassinate President Kennedy. The Mamaca Carcano rifle discovered on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository was swiftly linked to Oswald. However, experts have cast significant doubt on its reliability. Firearm specialists have noted that this bolt-action weapon is unwieldy and challenging to fire accurately in rapid succession. Nevertheless, the official narrative asserts that Oswald managed to fire three shots in less than 6 seconds, striking a moving target with lethal precision.
The Mamaca is so cheap and hard to work, there's no way Oswald could get off three shots that fast.
The Mamaca Carcano with the bolt-action was so difficult. And when you sight in with the telescopic sight, after you work the bolt, you're thrown off the target and you have to re-sight again.
Even more suspicious are the inconsistencies surrounding the rifle itself. According to very questionable photographic evidence, Oswald was seen holding a rifle in his backyard. But critics argue that the weapon in the photo doesn't match the Mamaca Carcano found on the sixth floor. Some researchers have suggested the rifle photo may have been doctored, noting oddities in the lighting and proportion, and no fingerprints of Oswald were found on the weapon until days later, under highly questionable circumstances, aka a trip to the funeral home by federal agents where Oswald's body was being prepared for burial. Suddenly, after this trip to the funeral home, a palm print is found on the weapon. The Warren Commission relied heavily on the rifle's connection to Oswald to support their lone gunman theory.
I had gotten to the funeral home with his body something in the neighborhood of 11 o'clock at night, and it's a several-hour procedure to prepare the remains. And after this time, someplace in the early morning, agents came. Now, I say agents because I'm not familiar at the moment with whether they were Secret Service or FBI or who they were. But agents did come, and when they did come, they fingerprinted, and the only reason that we knew they did, they were carrying a satchel and equipment and asked us if they might have the perforation room to themselves, And after it was all over, we found ink on Lee Hardy's hands, showing that they had fingerprinted him and palm-printed him. We had to take that ink back off in order to prepare him for burial and to eliminate that ink.
Number two, the unlikely shooting position. Another point frequently raised in Oswald's defense is the actual location from which the shots were allegedly fired. Oswald was said to have been in the sixth floor southeast corner window of the Texas School Book Depository building, but witnesses and forensic reconstructions have shown that this was not the most logical or effective vantage point for a skilled shooter to target a moving motorcade.
Let me ask you something, Lou. Why not just shoot Kennedy coming up Houston? There's plenty of time. It's out in the open.
Oh, I keep asking myself the same thing.
It's a frontal shot.
Even if you miss him for the first shot, if they accelerate, you still got him for the second shot. No, the only reason for waiting to get him on out is you got him in a triangulated crossfire.
Healy Plaza was a well-documented crime scene, and many experts have recreated the event using computer simulations and first-hand analysis. These reconstructions often conclude that a shooter from the sixth floor would have faced significant visual and physical obstructions, including tree branches and signage, especially during the first few seconds of the shooting. Also, the shots that struck Kennedy appear to come from angles that are more consistent with a frontal or side shot, not from behind, as the official story suggests. Numerous eyewitnesses on the ground also reported hearing shots from the grassy knoll rather than the school book depository building. The directionality of the sound and the reactions of the crowd, many of whom rushed toward the grassy knoll instead of the book depository, have long been cited as evidence that at least one shooter was elsewhere. All these details have contributed to a growing body of thought that Oswald simply wasn't in the right place or position to carry out the shooting alone.
There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please.
Number three, the strange timeline of the officer J.D. Tippett murder.
Tippett had called him over to the car door. He leaned in and talked to him, they said, for a few seconds. And then Tippett got out and started walking around the front of the car to get to him. And Oswald stepped back 2 or 3 feet. And when Tippett got to the left front fender of the car, Oswald pulled out his pistol and went into this Marine stance that he'd been taught. And just bang, 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 bang 4 times, just like that. He didn't move his gun up and down. He had left it steady. And so the first shot that hit Tippett was low along the belt area, and the next one a little higher. He went forward with the first shot, and he started turning to his left, and the bullet walked on up his body as he fell. When he was going down, he fell on his left side, and as he went down, his head passed the line of view, the line of shots, and the bullet hit him in the temple and come out the top.
Officer J.D. Tippett, 38 years of age, was killed today.
The entire area has been blocked out. No one allowed in or out as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas.
Oswald was apprehended not for killing JFK, but for the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippett. According to police reports, Tippett was shot around 107, but the Warren report states it was 115. But hospital records show Tippett was at the hospital by 1:15 p.m. We know for 100% certainty that Oswald was at his rooming house between 1 to 104 to 105 p.m. He would then have to travel on foot 9/10 of a mile to the Tippett murder scene. It's an impossibility, even if Tippett was killed at 1:15 like the Warren Commission claims. But we could do an entire episode on witnesses that said Tippett was killed between 105 to 109 p.m.
Timeline that they have to put together, the Warren Commission, is the entire crazy pretzel logic of trying to construct a timeline for Oswald every waking minute of that day. They have to monkey around with the time of death to make it fit into Oswald's timeline, because we know Oswald was back at his rooming house. Housekeeper was watching CBS News, Days of Our Lives. It's interrupted by a CBS News bulletin. We know the time of the bulletin. We know what time Oswald shows up. The situation at the rooming house, where Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, sees him, that's kind of like a touchstone, because that's like she sees him get into his coat. She sees him leave. She sees him go to the bus stop across the street, and it's like 1:04. So we know what time Oswald gets to the rooming house. We know what time he's across the street. And Oswald literally has 10 minutes or 8 minutes to go a mile from his house to the location of the shooting. Now, the shooting was anywhere from 105, 106. Put it this way. He's dead at the hospital, 115. He's dead at the hospital. So whatever happened, he's at the hospital, and they originally wrote 107 on the death certificate, and they typed over that 115. So everybody is monkeying around, Dallas police, FBI, with this timeline, trying to get Oswald from his rooming house to the shooting and then get him to the theater and figure this whole thing out. And no matter how many times they hear this thing, it doesn't work well. And in here lies an incredible amount of corruption and framing of Oswald.
Oswald was then picked up at the Texas Theater at 1:50 p.m. However, multiple timelines conflict when trying to place Oswald at the scene of Tippett's murder in the short window of time available. Some witnesses have claimed to have seen Tippett speaking to a man who did not match Oswald's description shortly before the shooting.
Now, when you heard the shots and you went out of the house, did you see a man with a gun?
Yes, I did.
What was he doing?
He was reloading.
How would you describe that man?
Well, he's kind of chunky. He's kind of heavy, wasn't a very big man.
Was he tall or short?
He was kind of short, yeah.
Short and heavy.
Other witnesses have stated Oswald was already at the theater at the time Tippett was killed.
We were playing two movies called War as Hell with Audie Murphy and Trial Battle with Ben Heppard. We started the movie at 1 o'clock, and I was counting candy behind the candy case. And he also slipped in around between 1 and 1:07.
These contradictions have led to years of speculation that Oswald was being framed or was intended to be eliminated as part of a larger cover-up. Adding to the confusion, the shell casings found at the Tippett crime scene reportedly did not match Oswald's revolver. Also, there were conflicting reports about how many shooters were involved in Tippett's murder.
I showed that.
Short and heavy.
Yes.
And was there any other man there?
There's a woman on the side of the street. All I know, he told him to go.
Mrs. Clemens, the man who had the gun, did he make any motion at all to the other man across the street?
No more, I told him to go.
Well, he waved his hand and said,
"Go on."
And then what happened with the man with the gun?
He unloaded and reloaded.
And what did the other man do?
Man kept going straight down the street.
And then did they go in opposite directions?
Yes, they weren't together. They went this way from each other. The one down the shooting went this way. The other went straight down past two, that way.
What was the man who did not do the shooting, but the man who went in the other direction from the man with the gun? What was he wearing, remember?
Well, I remember how it looked like light khakis and a white shirt.
And was he tall or short?
He was tall.
And was he heavy or thin?
He was thin.
But the one who did the one who had the gun, seconds after Tippett was shot, he was short.
He was short and kind of heavy.
Did you testify before the Warren Commission about this?
I haven't said anything to anyone.
Number 4. How many wallets did Lee Harvey Oswald own? Another issue that has raised questions over the years is the numerous wallets that was supposedly found the day Oswald was arrested. One was found at the scene of the Tippett shooting, and one was taken off Oswald after he was arrested in the police car on his way to the station.
there's, you know, the wrong definition of Oswald's wallet being found at the scene. The wallet has been, unfortunately for the Dallas police, found on Oswald himself. So the phony wallet had to disappear, even though it was filmed by Dallas News. And you hear the two cops talking about Alec Heidel on the identification that he's pulling out of the wallet. And they're going, do you know an Alec Heidel? And this is clearly a planted wallet because Swold's got his own wallet on him an hour later when he's arrested at the Dallas Theater. And this wallet angle completely disappears from the news very quickly.
Number 5, the polygraph and voice stress test evidence. While Oswald was never given a polygraph test, various forms of modern analysis have been applied to his speech and behavior during his brief time in custody. One of the most discussed is the application of voice stress analysis to Oswald's recorded interviews and statements. These tools, often used in law enforcement today, are designed to detect deception through vocal tone patterns. Several independent studies using Oswald's televised statements, such as his famous "I'm just a patsy" comment, have been examined using these technologies. Analysts claim that his voice did not exhibit the stress patterns typical of someone lying. In other words, Oswald may have genuinely believed what he was saying, and he was just what he said he was, patsy. Furthermore, the way Oswald handled questioning has intrigued psychologists and profilers for years. He remained remarkably calm, repeatedly denied any involvement, and never confessed even when faced with overwhelming pressure. Unlike many suspects who eventually break under interrogation, Oswald held to his story until the end, reinforcing the belief held by many that he was innocent.
You were the first to interrogate Oswald and the last to speak to him before he was killed. What was he like? How did he come over to you?
When I began talking with him, of course, I was talking to him about the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. At that time, I didn't have a clue that he was going to be a suspect in that presidential shooting. And at that time, he answered all my questions willingly, and as soon as I asked him, he didn't hold back on anything. He was very calm and collected, and I couldn't imagine anybody who had just killed two people could be so calm and collected as he was.
Number 6, the lack of motive and connections.
No, sir, I'm not a communist, and I think that the red herring and so forth is rather ridiculous to toss into this conversation.
And are you a Marxist?
Well, I have studied Marxist philosophy, yes, sir, and also other philosophers.
But are you a Marxist? I think you did admit on an earlier radio interview that you consider yourself a Marxist.
Well, I would very definitely say that I am a Marxist. That is correct.
Prosecutors and investigators are often guided by the question of motive. Why would someone commit such a monumental crime? In Oswald's case, the official narrative paints him as a disgruntled loner with radical political leanings. But when examined closely, motives become murky at best. Oswald had a history of supporting both far-left and far-right ideologies at different times, which has led to confusion over his true political stance. His supposed sympathy for Castro's Cuba has been cited as a reason for wanting Kennedy dead. But this theory overlooks Kennedy's back-channel negotiations with Castro towards normalization, which may have actually appealed to Oswald. If he was a passionate Marxist, the notion of killing a president quietly working towards peace with communist nations seems inconsistent. His mysterious connections to intelligence agencies further complicate the picture. Oswald's time in the Soviet Union, his strange re-entry into the U.S., and his odd interactions with various pro- and anti-Castro figures in New Orleans suggest he may have been used or monitored by intelligence agencies. Number 7. Eyewitness contradictions and forgotten testimonies.
Let out by Captain Fritz. There is a prisoner. There is Lee Oswald.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot.
Much of the case against Lee Harvey Oswald relies on the official testimony presented to the Warren Commission. However, many eyewitnesses to the events of that day offered statements that contradicted the Commission's findings or were left out altogether. Over time, researchers have uncovered accounts from individuals who described hearing gunfire from multiple directions, seeing suspicious individuals not matching Oswald's description, and witnessing strange behavior from law enforcement that day. One of the most cited examples is the testimony of Jean Hill, who stood near the motorcade route and insisted she heard 4 to 6 shots, not 3. Hill also claimed to see a man running from the grassy knoll immediately after the shots were fired.
That day and those images will remain forever in our minds, but for Jean Hill, the closest eyewitness to JFK's assassination, the last 28 years have been a nightmare that almost drove her to suicide. She is the famous woman in red, as they say, who was so close to the motorcade that she saw the president being shot while blood splattered all around her. Take us back there, 28 years ago, Jean, if you could.
Oh, I can't.
I bet you can. Every day you...
Every day. I could take you back. On that day, my friend Mary Mormon and I had gone downtown to see the president, but we were in the triangle between two streets just across from the grassy knoll, and there was no one over there, so we walked up and down for about 20 minutes to find the most advantageous spot.
Here comes the motorcade.
It was just, we got caught up in it, and I dashed out to the edge of the street, and I started to touch the car, and you just don't do things like that, and I yelled, "Hey, Mr. President."
And your friend had a Polaroid
uh-huh.
camera, and she wanted to take pictures.
Right.
So when you yelled to the president, "Hey, Mr. President, we're over here."
Yeah.
She's taking pictures.
She's taking pictures.
And then what happened?
And just as he started to turn and look at me, and his hand came up, I thought to wave, and all of a sudden the shots ring out, and he grabbed his throat. It was just horrible. There was a series of shots, and I saw this flash of light and the puff of smoke from the knoll in front of us.
Where, by the way, the Warren Commission says nothing ever took place.
Oh, I saw it.
You saw that puff of smoke.
Oh, I did.
You know something happened at the knoll.
I know someone was shooting from there.
How far would you say you were from that car?
Oh, at one time I could have touched the car.
When it happened, how far were you?
I had jumped back up on the curb. Just a little further than I am from you.
You were this close to the president?
Yes. Oh, yes. Too close.
This happens, you hear the shots, and you see what, a man?
I just saw the smoke and the light from the knoll where I knew someone had shot.
Right.
And at that instant, his head was blown off.
Right.
And the blood and the brains and all this just made a red cloud around President Kennedy's head. It was just horrible.
And then you saw a man.
Yes, I saw
running.
A man. Well, you've got to realize that it was like a freeze frame in TV. Nothing was moving. Everything was so still. It's like, well, we were all in shock. It was such a traumatic event. And I looked up and I saw this man right in front of me at the top of the hill. And he was walking very fast back to where I had seen someone shooting, and I thought, he's getting away, and there were so many, the shots were ringing out. I said at least 4 to 6.
Right. And the Warren Commission says no more than three.
And when I'd heard that many, but I thought it was just the good guys and the bad guys shooting back, and I thought, you must be a bad guy because you're running away.
Right.
And we're not. And I thought, I've got to catch him. Somebody's got to catch him.
So you ran up?
I ran across the motorcade and ran up on the hill, back into the parking lot looking for him. And when I got up there, a man grabbed me from behind on my shoulder in an extremely painful grip and said, "You're coming with me." And I said, "I can't. I've got to catch this man. Help me." And he had shown me some ID, Secret Service, he
Did
said.
Did he say Secret Service?
Yes, sir.
And in fact, there was no Secret Service agent in that whole area except on the motorcade.
That's what I've been told later.
Yeah.
But at that time...
I just want to say what's been said.
Yeah.
There was no Secret Service agent in that area if it wasn't on the motorcade itself. It wasn't on that car.
Other witnesses describe men with radios or suits acting oddly near the knoll just before the shooting, suggesting coordination rather than a lone act. The Warren Commission's report largely dismissed these conflicting accounts in favor of a streamlined narrative. But later investigations, including the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the late 70s, acknowledged the probability of a conspiracy based on acoustic evidence. Number 8. Oswald's own behavior and statements. Oswald's own words and actions in the 48 hours following the assassination offer some of the most compelling reasons to doubt his guilt.
Here comes Oswald down the hall again.
You fire that rifle. That's as fast as you people have been getting, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Upon his arrest, he denied all accusations and asked for legal representation. A standard move, but not one underscored by his repeated statements that he didn't know what was going on.
I positively know nothing about this situation here. I would like to have legal representation. Well, I was questioned by a judge. However, I protested at that time that I was not allowed legal representation. During that very short and sweet hearing, I really don't know what the situation is about. Nobody has told me anything except that I'm accused of murdering a policeman. I know nothing more than that.
His repeated phrase, "I'm just a patsy," became iconic and has fueled alternative theories ever since.
I don't know what this is all about.
You killed the president?
No, sir, I didn't keep a gun in the
sir? You shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man!
Come on, man.
President?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet
Union.
I'm just a patsy.
Oswald seemed genuinely shocked by the charges being leveled against him.
You killed the president?
No, I've not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
According to the police and media interviews, he cooperated to some extent, but consistently denied any involvement. He didn't attempt to flee the country or destroy evidence. His behavior was erratic, but not consistent with someone who had just pulled off the crime of the century. He appeared calm, elusive, and confused more than anything else. After being shot by Jack Ruby in police custody, Oswald never got a chance to fully defend himself in court. In other words, he may have taken the truth of the John F. Kennedy assassination to his grave. Next week, we start a series on what some have called the Rosetta Stone of the Kennedy assassination, the killing of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. In his 1973 book entitled November 22, 1963, You Are the Jury, David Bellin, who was assistant counsel to the Warren Commission and one of the chief defenders of the Warren Report, asserts that the Rosetta Stone to the solution of President Kennedy's murder is the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. He states, quote, "Once it is determined that Oswald killed Patrolman J.D. Tippit, there can be no doubt that the overall evidence shows that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin of John F. Kennedy." End quote. Well, let's just look into that next week, shall we? We'll see you then. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.